Good evening, and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Jack Lepiarz. Tonight, we have a lecture presented by the Boston University Elie Wiesel Center for Jewish Studies titled, First, They Killed My Father. A Daughter of Cambodia Remembers. Our speaker is American-Cambodian human rights activist and author Luong Hung. We begin with an introduction by tonight's moderator, Boston University Assistant Professor of French, Jennifer Cazeneuve.
The acclaimed writer Luong Hung survived the Cambodian genocide. This evening, her talk will enable us to commemorate the 40th anniversary of the fall of the Khmer Rouge, a brutal regime spanning from 1975 to 1979, during which nearly 2 million Cambodians perished from forced labor, famine, disease, torture, and execution. In the aftermath of the Khmer Rouge, many survivors fled the country and reached refugee camps along the Thai border. Some would eventually return to Cambodia, while others resettled in countries such as France, Australia, and the United States. Luong Hung made her way to Vermont in the early 1980s. It is worth noting that during this period, the city of Lowell, just north of Boston, welcomed its first Cambodian refugees. Today, Lowell is home to the second largest Cambodian community in the United States. It is a pleasure for me to introduce Luong Hung this evening, as I had the opportunity to travel to Cambodia for the first time this past summer. In Phnom Penh, I met young filmmakers whose parents had survived the Khmer Rouge regime. While they were born after the genocide, these filmmakers felt that they must continue to tell the story of their country's traumatic past. In Phnom Penh, I visited the S-21 prison, a former high school turned into a torture and execution center by the Khmer Rouge, who carefully photographed prisoners and transcribed interrogations. On the same day, in the outskirts of the capital, less than 10 miles away, I also visited mass graves known as killing fields. The term killing fields was popularized in the English language by the 1984 eponymous film directed by Roland Joffé, the first major motion picture to focus on the atrocities committed by the Khmer Rouge between 1975 and 1979. As I discovered during a six-hour bus ride, which took me from Phnom Penh to the temples of Angkor, the killing fields of the Khmer Rouge are scattered throughout the Cambodian countryside. Yet, in 2019, many are unmarked, such as the ones I learned that separated my hotel from the temples of Angkor. Over the course of my trip, I began to see these unmarked mass burial sites not only as killing fields, but also, to borrow the title of the latest film by the child survivor and filmmaker Riti Pan, Graves Without a Name. To write from a place of survival entails not only recounting the traumatic history of Cambodia, it also means, notably in a memoir such as Luong Hung's First They Killed My Father, to remember and mourn those who perish and who were never given a proper burial or grave. Please join me in welcoming Luong Hung to Boston University.
Thank you so much for that introduction. Writing from a place of survival. I started this really on April 15, 1998, when I woke up to the news that Pol Pot, the Khmer Rouge leader, had died. In his last interview, Pol Pot told a reporter that his conscience was clear, that everything he did in life, he did for Cambodia. And he spoke of this in a tone that spoke of someone who thought it was of great love, speaking of great love. And I was in Washington, D.C., sitting in my office. It was a beautiful spring day. The birds were chirping outside my window. The sky was blue. The tree leaves were green. And all I could feel in that moment was rage and anger and sadness. How dare he said his conscience was clear? How dare he spoke of what happened in Cambodia with any connotation of love? For love does not a genocide make. Love does not torture. Love does not harm. Love does not commit mass murders. Love does not kill 1.7 to 2 million Cambodians, a population of the country. Love does not hurt, harm, torture, kill. On that day, I set out to negate Pol Pot's legacy with my pen, with my words, with my stories, for I wanted to tell my own story of love, the story of what love looks like to a family, to a daughter, the love between a mother and son, between history and a nation, between the soul and spirit. This love story would eventually become my first book, First They Killed My Father. I began my love story, like many other love stories in our world, with my family. I arrived in this world in 1970. Though I didn't know it, much of our world was already embroiled in wars fought in places called Afghanistan, Mozambique, Angola, places I didn't know, never heard of. And in my country, the war in Vietnam had crossed into Cambodia, bringing with it B-52 metal killing birds that were dropping bombs onto our countryside to chase after the South Vietnamese army that were supposedly hiding in our land. A war, a bombing campaign that would eventually drop over 500 tons of bombs onto Cambodia, more than all of the bombs the Allies dropped during World War II. But I didn't know about this war. I didn't know about America. I didn't know about the B-52 metal killing birds. For my love story started with a father who was a military police officer, afforded us a lifestyle privilege, and a mother who at 5'7", was considered an Amazon in our society. So busy she was raising my three very cool brothers in their bell-bottom pants, obsessively listening to Elvis Presley music on their 8-track tapes, thinking they were so cool growing out their Elvis sideburns, which they did not succeed in doing. My love story also was spent with three sisters who I played with and fought with so loud and so often that my father threatened to replace us with monkeys. For those of you who've been to Cambodia, we have many monkeys. Thankfully, my father never followed through with his threats. My love story was with a Cambodia that was so green. To this day, I've yet to find that green crayon in that box of 164 to fill in its scenery. A Cambodia that was rich in culture, art, vibrancy, with 2,000-year-old history and architectures and architects who built the largest religious complex in the world, the Angkor Wat. A Cambodia, a kingdom the size of the state of Oklahoma, that was populated by 7 million people, 90% of which were Buddhists, 90% of which were farmers, and the rest were people trying to live in peace, worshiping whichever religion and faith they chose to. My Cambodia was not the Cambodia of the killing fields. My Cambodia was one where I spent educating my mind, where my father and my mother sent me to school 3 times a day, 6 days a week, studying Chinese, Cambodian, French, and English. My Cambodia was one where my fondest memory of childhood was on that Sunday off, where as a family, we would either go on a picnic to the pagoda or to the movie theaters across from our house. We're in a room like this. The 9 of us would sit in a row, and my father would sit that way that father just know how to do, with his leg crossed ever so. And in my hands, on his lap, I would hold my favorite junk food. Even back then, I had a taste for fried crickets. It was much crunchier than popcorn. Never get stale. After about 40 trips to Cambodia, I've now acquired a taste for fried tarantulas. They're kind of like tater tots. If you can get past the crunchy outside and spidery in the middle. And if you have a fear of spiders, as many Americans seem to have, eat them. fear gone. My childhood, I thought, was charmed. But that charm childhood would come to an end on April 17, 1975. The day the Khmer Rouge came into my city in their trucks, wearing black shirts and pants, smiling, screaming to us, the war was over, the war was over. And I had no idea what this war was. I didn't know about the Americans. I didn't know that the Khmer Rouge, the Red Cambodians, as they were known, the communist followers in Cambodia that took power, had been in existence in our country since the 1940s, when they formed to fight against French colonializations in Southeast Asia. I didn't know that for the next 20 years, the group operated mostly in the rural Cambodia countryside, engaging in skirmishes against the ruling government, led by Prince Sihanouk. I didn't know about the civil war that went on for 5 years, or how the U.S. war crossing into Cambodia and the bombing campaigns gave the Khmer Rouge, the communist group, a propaganda tool to recruit followers and fighters. I didn't know that when the U.S. left Vietnam and then withdrew of Cambodia, the Khmer Rouge was ripe to take power, to come in with their group and committee of brothers, to take over the country, to create a vision, a country in their vision of a new Cambodia, an agrarian Cambodia where power would be taken from the elites and given to the poor, where people would be separated to those who were pure of heart, the true revolutionaries, people who believe in the ideology and philosophy, to all the others who view as traitors and enemies of the state. I didn't know about the Cambodia who came in, who wanted and to abolish money, free markets, schools, private properties, religious practices, traditional Khmer culture. And they came in and shut down all our schools, mosques, church, shops. They decreed it unlawful if more than people gather in a meeting. They forbade personal and familial relationships, for the revolution commanded your complete loyalty. I didn't know all this. All I knew was that on that day, my parents gathered us together and told us we had to leave our homes. We were to pack as little as we could, that we could carry to sustain us for 3 days, because the soldiers said the Americans were coming in with their bombs, and if we didn't leave, we would all be killed. It would be the soldiers' first lie, I remember. For I know now the scars of bombs and wars would take many more than 3 days to heal. But I didn't know that. Myself, along with 2 million other Cambodians living in the city of Phnom Penh, was evacuated in 72 hours. What would you pack if that had been your family and your city? Where would you go? What would you leave behind? And what if it happened on a day like this and you're here and we're here and you've got family members and loved ones in a different part of the city, in a different part of the country, and you never made plans to meet up with them again? How would you find them? And that was the fates and the fights and flights of so many Cambodians that to this day we are still looking for names on all these different listservs for people we lost on that day. My family, we thought we were lucky. We were together. And so we went off into this new Cambodia. A Cambodia where all its citizens were turned into prisoners. And all its prisoners were forced to leave cities and lifestyle they have known and grew up with to live in villages, more in rural camps that were more akin to labor camps, where every day consisted of only Mondays and every Monday a work day, and it did not matter if you were 6 or 60. You got up, you dug trenches, you built dams, you grew food that the soldiers came with their trucks and took away from you to go fight a war you didn't vote for, you didn't want, you didn't understand, and you had no right, and you had no say, and you had no voice, and you could not fight. because to do so not only meant a danger to you, harm to you, but a danger to your loved ones, to your families, to your brothers, to your fathers and mothers. I was 6 years old when I learned that to have the privilege of taking that next breath, I would have to become dumb, deaf, mute, blind, and invisible. Where would you go find sanctuary for your mind? Where would you go find a safe place for your heart if there was no safe place? If your spoken words could not just get you hurt, but your families killed? And so I learned to silence myself. I learned to become invisible, just so I could live. At this time, even though I didn't know what was going on, and I didn't know the policy of Cambodia, the Khmer Rouge politics, I could see with my very own eyes the people and family members who were disappearing in the villages we were at. For this new government, the Khmer Rouge, who call their government ANCA, which translated into the organization, was nameless, faceless, people we didn't vote in, people we didn't know. They set out a policy that anybody who didn't see the world in their viewpoint were their enemies. And their solution for such enemies was to purge and crush them. And so they sent out their soldiers into the villages and the countryside. And in that first wave, they gathered the doctors, the lawyers, the architects, the readers, the singers, the musicians, the weavers, and they had these people executed en masse. And still they looked, and still they saw enemies, and still they saw people who could speak up, who could possibly stand up, who could maybe someday be heard, and they gathered and sent out more soldiers. And this time they took away the sons and daughters and nephews and sisters of the people they'd killed. There was no safe place for us. For as long as I live, I will never forget the day the soldiers came for my father. They came with their excuse that they had an ox cart stuck in the mud and they needed his assistance. My father talked to my mother, and I heard her cry in a way I've never heard my mother cry before. And when he came back out of the hut, he picked up my brothers and sister one by one in his arms. And when it was my turn, I somehow had the instinct of mind to wrap my arms around my father, to remember the feeling of my face resting against his neck, to remember how his arms tighten around me as my feet dangle in the air, to whisper to my father that I loved him. And when he put me down and walked off into that sunset with the soldiers on either side of him, the gods that night painted the sky this palette of gold, magenta, red, and pink. And it was a heaven so beautiful that I wonder if other people were looking at this same sky and saw such beauty. And yet I only saw hurt and hate. I looked at that same sunset and wished the sun could somehow become a weapon, and that weapon could go off, and that when it went off, we would all be taken with it so I would not have to wake up. How was it possible that the gods could be looking down at us, could see us, and if they saw us, why didn't someone somewhere do something? I didn't understand. I was not yet 7 years old. What do you pray for your children or grandchildren or brothers or sisters when they were seven? What do you wish for them? When my father was taken, I prayed first for him to return, And then I stopped that, and I prayed only for the gods to have mercy, to take my father, to make sure he died with a bullet from the soldier's gun, to make sure his death was quick and painless. To this day, I do not know what happened to my father. But this I know. Cambodia, a beautiful country the size of the state of Oklahoma, is today littered with over 20,000 mass graves. Over 1 million skulls have been accounted for. Somebody's fathers and brothers and sisters and mothers. I do not know what happened to my father, but to this day, I wish for his death to be quick and painless. I was not yet 7. Hate took root in my heart. Rage grabbed hold of me and did not let go. And that rage grew even more when 3 months after my father was taken from us, my mother gathered us together and said we had to leave her. She instructed my brother to go east, my sister to walk south, and for me to go north. She told us to separate and not stay together. She told us to go find places where there were orphanages, camps, perhaps places they would take in children. She told us to tell these people who found us that she was dead already. I couldn't do that. In my Buddhist culture, it is sacrilegious, prophecy fulfilling, to say of a loved one they are dead when they are not. But my mother insisted that I did. And when I was angry and refused to leave, she turned me by my shoulders, pushed me out by the and out the door and said, "Get out." I thought my mother was weak. I thought she didn't want me. I felt abandoned by her. It would take me many more years and coming to America and working for 3 years at a domestic violence shelters in Maine to realize that my mother was not weak, that she was a woman of great strength. For she knows, as many mothers in our world know that to keep me safe, she had to push the strength that she knew would make me leave her, that she had to make me angry, even if that anger was directed at her. It was her courage and sacrifice that I am here today. And I'm so proud to be my mother's daughter. But I did not know this. And so I thought she was weak, and I marched off, eventually ending up in different places, eventually ending up in a camp where the supervisor of the camp saw the rage and the anger and the pain, and they didn't pull me aside and said, "Hate will only breed hate." They didn't pull me aside and try to teach me how to read or write, be a critical thinker, be a leader. They didn't put me in classes where they taught me to expand my horizon, to look at people and diversity as something that we embrace. It's something that we celebrate. They took me out and didn't teach me about teamwork and friendships to play sports. They put guns half my body's height, a third my body's weight, and taught me to hurt and hate and kill. They told me the world wanted me harmed, that as the child, a child of revolution, I was in danger. And to survive, I had to take others out first. And so the hate and the rage and the hurt grew. And it directed this time at my mother. I am so fortunate, so blessed that my war ended when I was 9 years old, on January 7th, 1979. And it ended before I was put out to fight a war in the front line. It ended before I had to kill another person. It didn't end soon enough for many other friends of mine who had to experience that. And it ended too late for the 1.7 to 2 million Cambodians who would die to starvation, diseases, hard labor, and execution. Still, I thought we were lucky. Still, I thought we were blessed because five of my Ungs, the Ung siblings, made it out of the killing fields. Although that genocide claimed the lives of both my parents, two sisters, and 20 other relatives, one of my sisters was 4 years old. What kind of enemy of the state does a four-year-old girl make? What kind of enemies, what kind of fear, threats, harm to your life does a girl too afraid to leave her mom, too small to find food, too scared to find a voice? What kind of enemy does that make? To this day, I do not know what happened to my mother and four-year-old sister. But I wish for them what I wish for my father, that their deaths were quick and painless. But I lived. Through the grace of my parents and their courage and sacrifice, and a year after the genocide had ended, my brother Meng and sister-in-law decided we were going to go look for a different life in a different place. There were two ways out of Cambodia then. You either walk the land and cross the borders of land between Cambodia and Thailand, where we knew there were refugee lands, land that we knew was littered with these tiny little weapon systems called landmines, the size of a hockey puck, a compact powder, once in the ground, stay active for decades. Landmines are weapon systems that is said to be the most painful injury, second to burns when you step on it. For everything below you, rocks, dirt, grass, toenails, bones, disintegrate, shooting up in your limbs, working like secondary missile. And to survive, it is a lifetime of pain and scars. For children who survive from mind blasts, it is a lifetime of pain and scar revisited. For a child's body heal, but the bones will continue to grow and will grow and protrude out of the stump. So had I stepped on a mine when I was 10, depending on how well the amputation was made, how fast I grew, how much food I was given, every 6 months, a year and a half, if I was lucky, I would have to return to a center and have my limbs cut and recut and cut and recut again until I stopped growing. My brother thought it was too dangerous of a route, and so he opted for the safer route, the boat people's route, in which we could find and buy seats on boats, and we were able to only raise enough gold to take three people out. So my brother was to go, my sister-in-law, his wife, and now he had to choose one of four siblings to take with him. Who would you take? Who would you leave behind? Knowing that the ones you take you might never see, and the one you leave behind might never live. I was the lucky child because I was chosen. And so we left, with anger and hurt, arriving at the refugee camps in Thailand. After 6 months of staying there, we were told we had been selected to go to this new place called America. We didn't know anything about America. The refugee workers try to show us America by showing us movies on big screens, movies with plot lines that took the storylines that took places in cities like Chicago, New York, Boston, with people of diverse skin colors and hairstyle, wearing short shorts, carrying boom boxes, weaving in and out of big, shiny buildings. And we looked at these cities, and we were told we were going to a place called Vermont, America. The whitest state in America. This is still statistically true. Eventually, for more diversity, I moved to Maine, the second whitest state in America. It was in America, when we arrived in June of 1980, that I realized that the world was a different place, that the world wasn't filled with rage and anger and hurt. Because we were sponsored by this group of parishioners from the Holy Family Church who made it their mission to show us a different world, a different way of living and existing. And I am so grateful to them to this day. for there were so many things to learn in this Vermont America. For one, we landed in June, and we were told it was their summer. We were told we were freezing, and we were told there was this thing called winter that was going to come very soon. We couldn't imagine what this winter, and they told us about snow falling from the sky, and I envisioned the ice blocks in Cambodia where they grind it and you put it in little cones, and then you put syrup on it and you eat it. I did not know this ice chips fell all from everywhere from the sky. And when that first winter came, we learned all the bad four-letter words. For you cannot tell a Southeast Asian girl, hey, it's cold in America, in Vermont, as it does here in Boston. It is freaking cold. There were so many things to learn. Things like, what is and was Uncle Ben's minute rice? It's not exactly rice. You cannot cook rice in 5 minutes. And what is, I mean, really, I didn't understand what meatloaf was all about. No matter how much ketchup you put on it, it is still just a chunk of meat without much spice. And unfortunately for me, I didn't speak any English, and I had to learn it very quickly, and it was the era of the Valley Girls. For those young people who do not remember, Valley Girls meant you start all your sentences with duh, and you end them all with gag me with a spoon. Not knowing English and also growing up speaking both Chinese and Cambodian, I was very creative with my language. And so I would go to school and say, gag me with a fork. Gag me with a chopstick. For if you can tell me why gag me with a spoon makes any more sense, I will put you in my next book, which is a novel about zombie vampires, Buddhist mythology. I didn't know about America and worked hard to learn and to leave the war behind. But wars do not end just because you leave it. War do not end because you travel 8,000 miles away. So war and the genocide returned and found me in America. And it found me every single 4th of July when my friends look at the sky and scream over excitement how exciting the fireworks was. And I am filled with fear and want to crawl on the bench and wondering why the Americans could not see the bombs exploding over their heads. Wars followed me in the hums of a mother's song, in the way a father play with his sons in the park, in the loud kick of a car engine, in the roar of a low-flying plane. War followed me when I was trying desperately to study geometry and spelling and, yes, English grammar. War followed me when my body turned from that of a girl to a young lady. And the last time I've seen that much blood coming out of a human body, they were dead or dying. And I was convinced I was going to do both. And the war came back, and I didn't have the words to say it. I didn't have the people to speak it to. And when I was so desperate, so sad, somebody gave me a book that would change my life. And the title of this book is called Man's Search for Meaning, a book by Viktor Frankl. It was a book that opened my mind and expanded my horizon. For in addition to learning what else happened and knowing that war and genocide and Holocaust and trauma did not only exist and happen to me, that it happened to millions of people in our world, that in the last century, over 120 to 160 million people have gone through some kind of wars in their states, in their nations, not counting the million more of people who are surviving domestic wars happening in their homes, in their relationships, in their communities, that we are not alone in our journey to heal, to grow, to evolve. And Viktor Frankl gave me a way to do this and started my writing from a place of survival. And so, inspired by his work and learning from him, I started journaling and documenting my experience onto the pages of my journals. And I wrote all the tears I could not cry, and I scream onto the pages the words I could not speak. and I wrote all the toxicity out of my body. And there is something powerful in naming the names and the things that fears that is fearful to you that make you afraid. For before I started writing and learning from logotherapy, the war existed over my head like this dark cloud that followed me everywhere I went, no matter where I went. And it followed in this dark cloud that would trigger by things I would not know and did not know, and then the clouds would rain on me or shoot lightning at me or harmed me in some way, and I had no way of detaching myself from it. But with my pen, with my small pen, I can poke its tip into this cloud, and I can one by one pull a single thread of story, of memory, of hurt, of tears, and I could translate that onto the pages, onto my journals, and I could make sense of it. I could look at it. I could manage it. And that was what logotherapy was for me, to be able to manage my trauma in a way that wasn't so overwhelming, and little by little, the clouds started to recede. And I wrote, and I wrote. And after a while, I looked at what I wrote and I realized that I was, though writing and reclaim my voice was still full of anger and pain. And that was not the voice I wanted to move forward with. That was not the voice I wanted to speak to me in my head, to follow me when I meet people and make friends and fall in love. I wanted a different voice. And when I needed most, another book found its way into my hands. And the book was called I Know Why the Caged Bird Sings by Dr. Maya Angelou. And in that work, in her work, she told me with brilliant, powerful voice that if anybody in our world should ever feel abused, embarrassed, ostracized, ashamed for what they went through, the abuse they suffer, it should never, ever, ever be the victims. That responsibility falls on the shoulders of the perpetrators. And then I start to see myself as not a victim and to hear a different voice. So that when I wrote that scene and we write the story of how when I was 9 and I was thirsty and I was collecting firewood in the forest and met a soldier and he offered me water and then he pushed me on the ground. And then he attempted to assault me. And I kicked, and I ran, and I escaped. And for 16 years after that, I had told myself this narrative that I was lucky. That how lucky was I that I escaped. And it wasn't until I read Dr. Maya Angelou's word and did change my narrative myself and looked at what happened to me that I saw that I didn't just escape, that my fist formed into a protective weapon, but my knees gained strength and kicked, that I screamed, that I fought a grown soldier's with a rifle off of me and I escaped. So it wasn't just that I escaped. I fought my way out of a rape. And in changing this narrative, I changed the very genetic DNA of my body. I changed how I breathe air. I changed how I walked. I changed how I take space when I'm in a room with people of all different sizes and shapes. And I change how I look at the world. I change how I look at all of us as survivors, as having strength and resiliencies, as maybe just being caught in a narrative that isn't our true story. I change my story from that of being fragmented to one where I could see the wholeness of not just my experience, but my mother's, my father's, all the other children I saw who escaped or survived or didn't but are here, because we are here and that is victory. We breathe and that is victory. We speak up and that is victory. We have life and that is victory. I am so grateful. I am so grateful for these books and many others who have taught me to learn to heal, to know that the world is full of beauty and possibilities, to be able to reduce the hate. And this I have also learned. For if writing is my tool to heal my internal self, activism is the work to balance my external environment, my external life. For hopefully, as with many other people who, whichever is their way of learning and healing their internal self, you dig deep, you go in, you learn. Hopefully you get to a place where you are bored of yourself, where you get bored of who you think you are, where you realize that this is not about you, where the question that keeps popping in your head is, now what? Now what? Now what? Where you realize that this, the answer to now what, is that it isn't about you. Where you can stand in front of an audience or speak to a friend and fight against the tear and the anger and still speak because you know it's not about you. Where you channel the soul and spirit of loved ones and people you don't know because they are part of the human race and therefore you love them anyway. Where you are there and you realize that they and all these other groups, the 1.5 charitable organization registered in the U.S., of people who are doing such great work, people who are your neighbors and your friends or your church members or your synagogue neighbors who believe in Islam, who believe in Buddhism, who believe in the beauty of our world, people who showed you that peace in our world is not a wish. Peace in our world is not something that is granted to us. Peace in our world is not something we ask for. It is not something we wait for the president to give it to us. It is not something that we wait for the next generation to work on. It is not something that we dream about. Peace is an action. Or rather, peace is many, many actions. Peace requires us to commit, to strategize, to work on, to plan, to celebrate and make it a part of our life. Not when junior is grown and in school, not when you graduate from college, not when you've saved enough in your nest egg fund that you can now work. Peace requires us to make it a daily affirmation where all it is just to be kind when you drive, to extend a hand when somebody needs it, to be a friend. Peace is being aware and being educated and being conscious, knowing that what we do matters. And knowing that when we do this work, we put out the most important thing. For all the other specific of what we can do on a daily basis matters, but when we do the work in whichever forms, whether as mothers or brothers, sisters, or as architects or weavers or dancers, in whichever capacity in our community, in our world, when we do this, we put out this glimmer of beauty that is the best examples of man's humanity to man. And to those of us who have witnessed the worst of man's inhumanity to man, this is what heals. This is what will change our world. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Ms. Ung. It was amazing to hear you speak, and we're so lucky to have you with us tonight.
So I've been to Cambodia, and I've seen the people there are so just so nice and friendly and caring and a great sense of community. How does a society turn to such violence when the core of the society is such, you know, most of the people there are, you know, loving, caring people. How does it turn? Do you have any insight into how that happens?
I ask this question of many things that's going on in our world. I'm asking this question of what's going on in America right now as well. And that is a topic that many scholars and many researchers have studied, and I wish I knew. I think in Cambodia it was a combination of many, many things. In I don't know if it's a question of how people were turned to violence as much as it was a tool that was presented and forced upon them, and it was a tool that was that some people picked up and chose to use, or forced or were forced to conscript it into the war. I know personally, when my parents were killed and I was taken, had the war not ended, I would have been a very affected soldier, mercenary, killer. I have no doubt about that. I had, and still to this day, an ability where if I choose to, I could just compartmentalize myself in my mind so that my heart isn't connected to my heart and my head and heart isn't connected to my soul, or my soul and body isn't connected to the earth and isn't connected to all of us here. And once you disconnect yourself, once you are estranged in a way to yourself, to your community, to our world, you put yourself in a vulnerability and position where you can do many, many acts of hurt and harm. In Cambodia, the history of it was full of distrust, full of fear from the Khmer Rouge and the communist group existing in the 30s and the 40s and the fighting against the French, and then the Vietnamese and the U.S. war coming in, and then the bombs coming in. And every time something came in, the people, the most vulnerable, were hurt and were harmed, and they didn't have power and they didn't have a voice. In the end, I think so many saw that this was the only way they could have power. They could have a say. And then there are people who use that. Just like we look at what's going on in our world, we are in a space of fear, and there are groups and there are people through horrible ways in social media who are using this and who are trying to grow this and who know exactly what they're doing. They know what they're doing when they use this tool, and if you put enough time into using the tool, it works. And so I'm very, very grateful that I never, that my war ended when it did. Because I have no doubt I would have been a great soldier for the cause.
Thank you.
Hello.
I just want to say thank you. It was actually one of my dreams to meet you. I watched, First They Killed My Father on Netflix many, many times. So I was wanting to know, I remember Googling your book, and there were some people who had a lot of things to say as to whether, you know, as a child, how you were able to remember all of that, and whether you and wanted to know the accuracy of, you know, of the book. So what was your response? What is your response to that?
Sure. Yes, you know, memoirs are, for me, my memoir is a collection of narratives and of my family stories. So it wasn't mine and mine alone. Before I actually started to write the book, I went back to Cambodia on 7 different trips. And I interviewed pretty much anybody who would talk to me. I interviewed my grandmother, my brothers, my sister. I asked my brothers and sister to write their narratives so that, and to this day, I have 100 pages of my brother's words that I took little bits of their facts. And I read books, watched documentaries, and I did a lot of research before I even sat down to write it. With that said, it is a memoir. It is not, I've never said that it's a definitive history book of Cambodia. There's so many wonderful books out there on that. Tsai Sho is a wonderful book. Henry Kam's book, The Cambodia Report from Stricken Land, is a great book. Many documentaries. What I did was, when I wrote the story, I wanted to honor my family's story. I wanted to honor the spirits of my grandmother in particular, because I remember when I was interviewing her, she did this thing that I kept with me the whole time I was writing. When I was asking her to share her story, and as she was crying and tears were streaming down her face, she didn't wipe her eyes, didn't spend time to wipe her face as much as her right hand was constantly rubbing over her heart in a circular motion. The whole time she talked, it was as if she was massaging her heart to either get the words out or to calm herself. And when I wrote, that was what I really kept in mind. And so there is that, and also the book is written from the point of view of a child's voice in the first person present tense. And I did it that way with a very specific goal in mind. One of my favorite books was To Kill a Mockingbird. And it was a beautiful book. Jam, and it's Scout in the book, spoke like a 50-year-old PhD professor. And that was not it. So I wanted to tell a story that took place with the immediacy of now. I didn't want my readers to have a barrier, to have an escape. I only wanted my readers to see what I saw, to know what I know. And whether or not that is truth or not, it was what I knew as a child, because that is what war really is like. If we could live wars in hindsight, I would have been able to maybe escape or maybe be there for my mother. If I could live my war in hindsight, I would not have stayed angry at my mother. If I could live my war in hindsight, if I could fix it, I would have hugged my mother before I left her. But I wanted the readers to feel the pain of the child who was angry at her mother for shoving her out. And so I wrote the book in the first person present tense. And when you write a book that way, there are many things you cannot explain. It would not be true to that narrative. So those are the two things, research and a specific point of view.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
This is Boston University's World of Ideas. You just heard a lecture by American-Cambodian human rights activist and author Luong Hung titled First They Killed My Father, A Daughter of Cambodia Remembers. Our lecture was presented by the Boston University Elie Wiesel Center for Jewish Studies. Tonight's moderator was Boston University Assistant Professor of French Jennifer Kazanov. For a CD of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. That's 1-800-909-9287. You can also go to our website, wbur.org, to hear archived editions of this and all other WBUR programs. Tonight's program was produced by Mike Toda and Michael Garth with help from Matt Lissette. The executive producer of Boston University's World of Ideas is Peter Lydodes. I'm Jack Lepiars. Thanks for joining us.